All right. Well, we've got a few people in the room. Everyone that's here, I see Roger, I see David Kelly, Dale, Nina, Scott. Folks, please share the room. You can do that, the little share button down below. You can ping people you know, you can share it on Clubhouse, share it on your social media. But we're going to get started. So, Jason, tell us about this topic.
All right. So in part one, I sort of talked about the Ayn Rand in an overall general sense about her theory of sexuality, which I thought she didn't have a theory. She had a sort of depiction of sex that sort of contrasted with her theoretical account of it in Atlas Shrugged. What I wanted to do in part two was talk about specifically Ayn Rand and homosexuality because her views on individualism in general and her philosophy in general really helped to sort of emancipate my soul from the dross and shame of growing up gay in Jamaica. And I wanted to talk a little bit about that and then to sort of talk about how the absence of what I take to be an objectivist view of homosexuality is a good thing in the sense that when we look at Rand's statements about homosexuality, disregarding her personal view that it's disgusting, but look at the philosophical statement she made about homosexuality and looking at the larger context of her view about sex, that we can derive an implicit view of what an objectivist, in the spirit of open objectivism, what an implicit view of an objectivist view on homosexuality would be, which I think would be a very emancipatory view. So I'll just sort of summarize the article that I wrote years ago called Ayn Rand Gay and Jamaican Gay and Ayn Rand Made It Okay, My Amazing Atlas Shrugged Love Story, and then go on to a general discussion of Ayn Rand's theory of sex, which shouldn't take me more than 15 minutes, and then we can open it up for discussion. So, I knew I was gay when I was about in my mid-teens, although I led a heterosexual life until I was in my late 20s, early 30s. But Ayn Rand makes it very clear in her philosophic system that the attributes of an individual, qua individual, his values that he has achieved and integrated in his character, and that give him his moral identity, along with his commitment to the absolutism of reason, or what he ought to value in his life, not the coveted glory that are wrought from achievements gained by individuals from his groups who have created something substantial on their own. So when one finds oneself riding on the social prestige of others' achievements, then one is a sort of moral parasite. So individual achievement does not translate into group achievement or group pride. The achievements of individuals, like their vices, have nothing to do with you. If you think that, then you're a biological collectivist, a mooch, or a parasite, as opposed to moral ambitiousness, a crucial tenet of Rand's philosophy. You become a walking practitioner of moral laziness and decrepitude. So you equate the beneficiary of being some phenomenon with being its benefactor because you share some tribal ancestral affiliation with the original creator. So that's an argument against collectivism. Now, when I read Atlas Shrugged and I read Rand's philosophy in Jamaica right before I left for America, I thought, being gay was nothing to be proud of. So being a collectivist, riding on the prestige of one's ancestors was nothing to be proud of, but it was nothing to be ashamed of either. So the identity had to be a morally neutral one that was sort of ensconced in the larger domain of how one lived one's life as a human being. So from Rand's philosophy, I thought, regardless of her personal opinion of homosexuality, which I'll talk about, I conjectured that if I were to tell her that I was gay, regardless of her own private subjective musings, the only rational answer that she could give regarding gay sex or any sex was that, Jason, it had better be good, because she thought that sex was not primarily for procreative reasons, it was for pleasure. So it had better be good. So long as I was not violating another person's right through consensual sex with him, then then the issue of gay sex had to be morally relevant. If not, it would be parasitic on religious moral pieties. So her philosophy, if consistently applied, would have to see sexual orientation as morally neutral. One could not judge the morality of a gay person just on the basis of his or her sexual orientation. One would have to sort of, I think, look at the context of that person's life.
Jason, you may be cutting out.
What I would call the paradigmatic configurations of sexual. Oh, I am? Okay. I'm gonna move closer to my
Yes.
How is this? Is this better? Okay, I'm closer to my modem. That's the problem. Okay, all right. So how he or she I lost my train of thought because I don't have this written down. How he or she behaved sexually. Was one promiscuous? Did one remain faithful to the values of monogamy and honesty, if such were the terms of one's spousal contract, or did one behave like a farm animal? Or did one choose sexual partners who represented one's highest moral values? So the truth of the matter, folks, is I think that homosexuality, simplicity, like heterosexuality, are morally neutral attributes of an individual, right? So from a non-mystical, sort of non-religious perspective, why would heterosexuality, let's take heterosexuality, why would heterosexuality be morally neutral and morally neutral attribute of an individual? Simply because it lies outside the realm of choice, just as hair color, eye color, or skin pigmentation. No one, and I mean no one, decides consciously to assign a heterosexual identity to him or herself, right? I've never found anyone, and I don't think science has ever discovered anyone who chooses on any particular day or over a series of days or years to assign a heterosexual identity to oneself. One finds oneself attracted to the opposite sex in a pretty natural and organic manner. One chooses a mate, one chooses to behave in a particular manner as a sexual being with his or her partner that is open to moral appraisal against the backdrop of knowledge relevant about the contracted agreement growing in their relationship and about the promises that we make to our mate. But we don't really choose our sexual orientation. Nobody sits down and says, today I'm going to weigh the pros and cons of being bisexual, gay, heterosexual, and today I choose to be heterosexual. We simply find ourselves inhabiting a sexual orientation. I mean, as Ayn Rand said, morality ends where choice ceases to exist or be possible. So since I'm yet to discover any individual who gave him or herself his sexual orientation, again, that is sitting down and weighing the pros and cons of being straight or gay and deciding to live a straight, I don't mean living a straight life, but assigning oneself an authentic, straight, entrenched, ineradicable sexual orientation. It seems ludicrous to me to consider homosexual orientation as anything other than neutral. I mean, Rand herself stated that sex was not primarily for procreation, but for pleasure. So the only proper advice one could give to anyone participating actively from an objectivist perspective is make sure that it's not non-altruistic, right? That it brings you pleasure, and I mean an immense amount of pleasure, that it cannot violate the bodily integrity of another person, so it cannot in any sense be initiated by force, and that it contributes to your own happiness. It cannot be altruistic. You cannot have sex for the sake of someone else. It has to be beneficial to you. It has to bring you personal happiness. But without falling into or being parasitic on religious edicts or pieties, Rand never gave a full or rational explanation for how and why even having multiple partners could be wrong or immoral. He stated it, but her reasons or why were just assertions with no really argumentation or substantive claims to back them up. So if one held reason as an absolute and a guide to the choice of one's actions, if one held productive work as one's noblest activity, and if one held happiness as one's highest moral purpose, the three central tenets of objectivism, I think all of those are compatible with homosexuality. And I don't think that one's orientation says anything about the values one holds and the ability to choose a partner who shares those values. In other words, homosexuality could only be wrong if it could be demonstrably shown that being a homosexual was detrimental to one's well-being and that it deeply compromised one's ability to achieve rational happiness as one's highest moral purpose and to be able to pursue productive work as one's noblest activity. But let's Jennifer and everybody else, let's see the adversary, the argument. What if homosexuality were chosen? Let's just say it was a choice that I could choose to be a homosexual. What difference would it make according to a rational objectivist? Because if sex, according to Rand, exists primarily for pleasure, not procreation, then gays would be the highest iteration, the highest metaphysical expressors of that principle, because their sexual activity cannot ever result in procreation. They then would embody and manifest, in Rand's view, the highest purpose and the meaning and value sex should hold for any rational human being. That is, sex devoid of any procreative possibility, and in Rand's formulation, existing solely for the pleasure of two people or more. And I would say that most people who engage in heterosexuals who engage in sex, for the most part, assuming they have sex more than 3-4 times a week or twice a week, most heterosexuals who have sex and engage in it for the sake of pleasure. Not for the most part, most heterosexuals do not engage in sex to have children. Assuming that you have two children or three children and you continue to have sex, it is for the purpose of pleasure. All right, a few more things I want to say here. I'm a bit hesitant, Jennifer, to bring in Rand's personal opinion on homosexuality. So objectively, in her talk at the Fort Hall Forum, she states emphatically that the state had no right to create laws, that is sodomy laws, to criminalize sex between consenting adults, that it was a gross violation of individual rights. And the reason being that the single most inviolable property that you possessed, that is, the property of your own body, could not be violated. That is, your sovereignty and your autonomy were inviolable, and they ought to be inviolate. But Rand could not help adding that, quote, "I think it's disgusting." Now, at the time of its utterance, I believe it caused a great deal of pain to many objectivist gays. In an era where homosexuality was still being heavily contested. In fact, it had just been, a few years, maybe 4 years, since it was removed from the American Psychological Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual as a pathology of perversion and a medical illness. So if we take disgusting, I mean, as an it's an adjective. Disgusting is an adjective, meaning arousing revulsion and strong indignation, causing a strong feeling of dislike and disinclination. If we take it as a noun, that is a feeling of revulsion aroused by something unpleasant or offensive, or if we take it as a verb, that which causes someone to feel revulsion or deep disapproval, or if we just take disgust, which is seen to be a core emotion that causes us to want to expel something that's toxic to us. It seems problematic because that which is toxic to us is very often constructed by a social narrative that comes to form the basis of people's fears and prejudices. I mean, Jews were thought to be disgusting to Jews as, you know, they were thought to be vermin and to be eradicated. Miscegenation, that is, intermarriage or sex between blacks and whites, were thought to be absolutely disgusting and toxic by racist whites in the South and outside the South. So very often that which is considered toxic or disgusting is quite often a social construct that has to be properly challenged. Now, I do want to say that Rand was very, very wise and judicious, and it speaks to her integrity as a philosopher that she did not in any way, what do I want to say? I'm wrapping up here, so I want to choose my words clearly. Rand was right in saying that emotions are not tools of cognition, right? So the fact that she found something disgusting was not a proper method of appraising the moral status of homosexuality. So emotions cannot appraise moral issues, nor can they adjudicate among truth claims. It is up to every self-respecting gay person possessed of self-esteem to hold Rand's emotional response to homosexuality as he would her emotional response to a particular flavor of ice cream as a matter of taste. And I've written extensively on this, that matters of taste cannot be elevated nor translated into statements of morality. In my third book, published about 12 years ago, I have a whole 50-page chapter written on why statements of taste or matters of taste cannot be translated into matters of morality. So she was cautious and wise not to advise that her emotions in this issue become entrenched into her legal practices. And here we see that Rand is very, very different than Lord Delvin's famous proposal that the disgust of an average member of society was sufficient reason for making a practice illegal, even if it caused no harm to others, which was much criticized when it first appeared in 1959 in response to the Wolf and Dunn Commission's proposal to decriminalize consensual homosexual relations. And support for Delvin's line of thought was very much in the rise. In 1997, for example, in The Anatomy of Disgust, the legal theorist William Miller argued that a society's hatred of vice and impropriety necessarily involves disgust and cannot be sustained without it. And Leon Cass, the chair of then President George Bush's Commission on Stem Cell Research, argued in his The Wisdom of Repugnance that, quote, our responses of disgust embody a wisdom that can steer us reliably in times of social change. And such views are built into many of our legal practices. Rand was very, very, very wise in resisting that line of argumentation, which really, really speaks to someone who realized that she had an emotional response, but that emotional response was actually not part of objectivism and should not in any way. You can look in Binswanger's objectivism through A through Z, and I don't think there's a section on homosexuality there. I'll just end there, that Rand was, in the philosophic sense, a great emancipator of gay rights because A, of her theory of pleasure, and B, because she was a stalwart defender of the view that the state had absolutely no business speaking specifically about homosexuality, creating laws that criminalized homosexual behavior. And that's as far as any philosopher can actually go in terms of protecting the individual rights of people. We do not necessarily need the philosopher's personal opinion or what I would call a matter of taste about the issue to secure the principle that defends and upholds the gay person's right to exist as a gay person without legal repercussions. And I'll end right there, Jennifer.
All right, thanks. Jason, if you would make me a moderator, because I want to pin a link to your Salon article and also start calling some people up on stage.
Oh, great.
So there you go. Oh,
I'm, I'm sorry, I didn't. My apologies.
Not at all. It's just, I consider myself a very prompt person, but Jason clearly got my dad's memo that to be on time, you got to be early. And he wasn't early, but he was earlier than I. So here we are. So I would love to get Damien's has a question. Anybody else, please raise your hand, comment. I mean, there's so much going on right now with issues like the controversy over DeSantis's legislation in Florida regarding what should or should not be taught to children, the whole question of transgender. So please raise your hand and we will get you up on stage. Scott.
Hi there. Great interview earlier with Isaac. Jason, great topic. Thank you for doing this. I just wanted to briefly say that, you know, I think that the fact that it had just been, you know, homosexuality had just been changed from not being a psychological condition, not trying to, you know, defend Rand, but that was, you know, it was just, she grew up her whole life learning that it was wrong. And so, but I think, you know, it's all about, you know, us moving in the right direction. But I think what one thing that you said that I thought about was that a lot of people ended up taking Rand's personal tastes as their own. Like, you know, I can't tell you how many of her fans are, you know, like Rachmaninoff fans, which is okay. You know, he's great, but it's just they wanted to like the things that she liked. So that was my comment.
Yeah, I want to say something, Scott. I don't really buy into the idea that Rand was taught this ideal, because Rand is a very unconventional thinking. Rand was also taught that altruism was cool and kosher, and she rejected it. Rand was also thought that Rand was thought everything that Rand went against, she was taught its opposite, right? So Rand was a very, very original and unconventional thinker. In her novels, I mean, her characters are having premarital sex. and she flagrantly has sex scenes that are really going against the time. But this is just being picky. Rand was taught a lot of things that she actively, consciously went against. So, I mean, in one sense, it's understandable that she is a human being who inherited a lot of the Victorian pieties of her age that she just wouldn't have questioned. But right. This is a woman who subjected almost everything that she was taught, every knowledge that was disseminated to her, to scrutiny and to question. So I hear what you're saying, but I'm also a little bit reluctant to accept that she was just a passive recipient of, you know, norms about homosexuality that she wouldn't have questioned. Because there were people in her time who grew up in the same era who rejected the idea that homosexuality was an aberration also.
David.
Thanks, Jason. This is really, really interesting. And I appreciate that you are, your take on Ayn Rand herself, and that the way in which her underlying philosophical principles made it possible for people to deal with homosexuality, embrace it as, you know, normal, proper, you know, potentially a valuable form of interpersonal relationship. One, I just want to make two points. One is that, I mean, I go back as an objectivist, I go back to the 60s, and my recollection, correct me if I'm wrong, is that there was an argument at the time to the effect that homosexuality is contrary to reason because it identifies, for example, in the case of a male, the male is not recognizing his own sexual identity insofar as he is attracted to other men. And I think I haven't checked this, and I should, so don't take this on my word, but I believe that was part of Nathaniel Brandon's early psychological courses for the Nathaniel Brandon Institute. Anyway, I remember having lots of discussions about this at the time and finally decided this is a circular argument, because to say it's an evasion, what exactly are you evading? The assumption is that men can only be attracted to women. Well, that's the issue. So you can't read that into the argument. So anyway, and I think we've come a long way since then. The other point, though, I want to make is the first point is that back in the origin days of objectivism, there was more than Rand's preference. She might have been above the fray in this, but my memory is that Nathaniel Brandon wasn't, although he later changed his mind completely. But the second point is this: you've contrasted pleasure with procreation as reasons for sex. On the pleasure side, you know, I think I understand what you're saying, but Rand's view about sexual pleasure was that it was integrated with not just physical attraction and physical excitement, but it with the values of your partner, and that it, so sexual, the best form of sexual experience is in the form of a romantic relationship. That might have been what you meant. I just wanted to pose it as a question to check. Thanks.
Right. So I when I said that one could not demonstrate, the only way that one could prove that homosexuality was wrong was if one could show that it was inimical to rational happiness. So the orientation itself and then the concomitant expression of that orientation was not inimical to the rational pursuit of happiness. That is, one could still be gay and still find someone who expressed, let's say one is a gay objectivist, and one could still find someone who expressed one's highest values, that is reason, productive work, rationality, benevolence, and all the shared values that are to be grounded in reason, and still find that sexual expression in pleasure would not contradict any of the tenets of objectivism. So I would still be hard pressed to find how just sexual orientation and its expression in a same-sex relation would go against reason. I don't think Rand ever gave a full-fledged thought out. She had some sort of quirky idea that it consisted of mixed premises, which I have never read. I know she said something about mixed premises, but I don't know that it ever evolved beyond a statement of mixed premises and what would be involved in mixed premises. I don't think it was ever developed into a theoretical account. But I agree with you that there is nothing, I've never seen a full-fledged account that would constitute a proof that being gay and finding a partner of the same sex who shares one's highest values, let's say in my case, a love of the intellect, a love of books, a love of literature, a love of music, traveling, a life devoted to reason, a life devoted to what Mill would call the higher pleasures, could not be found in someone with the same sex, and that could be expressed sexually also through an achieving pleasure. There's nothing that in being gay that could disqualify, in being gay simpliciter, that could disqualify one from achieving those values in another person of the same sex. That's actually what I meant by saying, for it to be wrong, one would have to demonstrably show that being gay in and of itself disqualifies one from achieving the state of eudaimonia or well-being at all, then if one could do that, if one could show that being gay and being a practicing gay person definitively disqualifies you from achieving your rational happiness, engaging in productive work as your highest cause, your most noblest activity, and engaging in reason itself as a choice to your values, then I would see the argument and say, okay, I've lost the argument, but I've just never seen that.
Okay, thanks, Jason. I heard such arguments at the time in the 60s and 70s. I finally decided they made no sense. They were circular or invalid. And eventually I just, you know, not an issue, not a philosophical issue. So I agree with you, but I think there was an effort on the part at one point to make an argument. It was invalid, it was circular or empty at best. And thank heavens we're past that.
Thanks, David. Damien. Damien, you want to unmute yourself and chime in or ask a question of Professor Hill?
Sorry, I couldn't. I lost the mute button for a second. For this particular topic, I actually don't have much to ask about. I mean, I don't understand necessarily. I feel like it's a preference, you know, whatever preference, natural preference or whatever. I don't understand how, like, people have objections to people's preferences. I don't even understand those types of conversations. That's just, a flaw of all of mine. But I guess really I wanted to ask a question because I missed part one and I listened back to the replay and I kind of found a part of that kind of fascinating. It's just that, you know, it was a lot of references to, you know, desire and knowing someone's values. And so for me, the first thing I thought about when I heard that is that, for me, I don't believe that it's about knowing anybody's values. To me, it's about believing. To me, that's where the desire comes from. It's your belief about with the information that you know about this particular person or that you see, you have created a belief in your own brain, in your own mind. You're kind of like relying on your subconscious, all of the programming or the mental filing that you've done in your own brain, and that just comes up unconsciously in the moment. And so therefore these desires aren't driven by knowing or knowledge, they're driven by belief. And so I don't necessarily have a real question, but that was the thing that for me just jumped out that I kind of just wanted to throw out there. And I guess an example of that to me is also, like, I know a lot of people are into art, and I guess in the objectivist community, like, when you see a piece of art and you have an emotional response, you don't have to have any knowledge of what that artist was thinking about when they did that. It's just something that resonates with you that you have an emotional response to. So I guess that's just what I wanted to throw out and see, like, what Professor Hill thought about that piece.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. And this is one of the minor quarrels I had with Rand when I talked about her depictions of sex versus her theoretical account of it, where Rand says, only the man who extols the purity of a love devoid of sexual desire is capable of the depravity of a desire devoid of love. And I thought, and I said that, no, we desire before we love. That is, we come to offer an emotion of love, or we come to have a desire before we even know anything about the person. I mean, heterosexual or gay, you walk down the street and you see someone, and you feel an attraction, you feel a desire, you feel lust, you feel, I'm attracted to that person, whatever physical attributes they may have and whatever physical attributes are most in the hierarchy of your physical attributes, whether it's the person's mouth, their eyes, their breasts, their other attributes that they have that you find stimulating. You're attracted to that person, and whether you pursue the attraction, you get to know them, but the idea that somehow, you know, that desire devoid, that love desire, that somehow, I spoke about this, where she conflates desire and love and attraction and treats them as if they're all coterminous is a fault. I do think, yes, that when we see a person, that there's a host of subconscious beliefs and ideas and projections that come. Can you hear me? There was a call that was coming in and I just declined. That there are a host of phenomena that come together that we project onto that person. And there's a great deal of work in psychology that deal with, you know, that explain what factors play into sexual attraction that go back to our childhood and the love that we receive from our parents are the first, or sometimes in some, I've read psychological accounts of the sort of things that we associate with security or the things that we associate with taboo. In many respects, there was a study done on interracial attraction and the things that we tabooize or the things that are taboo in our backgrounds or the extremes in others that we lack in ourselves, we're attracted to, you know. There are many, many phenomena that are at play in terms of what we find desirable in other people that have very little to do with conscious values. Now, I agree with Rand wholeheartedly that when you make the desire, the decision to spend a life or to build a life with someone, that of course values do play a central role, and you go from the role of belief into the role of judgments and the role of facts. That is, I'm attracted to someone and I may want to sleep with them, but I sit down in a conversation with them and I suddenly discover that they're a neo-Nazi or that they are some kind of superstitious wacko, and the desire dissipates and I feel actually a sense of revulsion. And I don't want to have anything to do with them anymore. And that's different. But the initial desire itself, I agree with you, Damien, is not based on values. I think the desire to make a life with someone or to build a relationship with someone, but attraction, desire, I think we desire before we love. And that seems natural, that seems normal. And if we look at, and I'll just end here, if we look at Dominic Franken's response to Howard Roark, when she comes upon him, it just coincidentally happens that she was right. But when she comes upon him in the quarry, she feels a desire. And she says to herself afterwards, I've been raped by a red-headed hoodlum, having known nothing about him. It's a strong, visceral, physical, lustful desire. She doesn't know anything that he's Howard Roark, that he's a genius architect who's been forced to work in a quandary. You're right. It's based on a visceral sexual attraction that she succumbs to. And the idea, unless we're going to lapse into some kind of mysticism and some kind of murky epistemological idea that you can just know by looking at his face and his rugged features, which I'm not buying at all. I don't think an irrational person would buy. She doesn't know. There's no way that she can know by his upright posture. Lots of Nazis had upright postures and grimaced faces and stern features. All the features that you see in Howard Roark, you can transpose them to a Nazi. You can transpose them to a psychopath. You could transpose them to any other person. It's not till Dominic really gets to know him that she can ratify and justify what truly happens retrospectively.
Thank you. And great, great insights, Damien. Brian.
Hey there. Appreciate the room. I have two questions. One I think is going to be relatively easy, and the other one may not be as easy. The first one, I'm assuming the characterizations you've given so far apply to bisexuals as well. And then the second question would be, what would the explanation be or the maybe the defense of one way or the other, children being kind of hypersexualized at such a young age and transitioned at such a young age by their parents and even brought up in an androgynous manner to kind of delay some of those desires or feelings or developments, and given hormone blockers and, you know, just the whole complicated issue that's come up recently. I don't suspect it was such a big issue, you know, back in the 70s and all that. But so just those two questions that applies to bisexuals and then the problem with children being transitioned at such a young age.
Right. Well, I feel this, the issue of bisexuality is also an orientation. That is, there are, and I for a period was bisexual in the sense that I did live a bisexual life, and it felt natural. Although retrospectively, I realized that it was authentic in one sense, that I did have sexual relations with women. It did feel natural, but it didn't speak to my authentic self. But I do think that there are authentic bisexual people by natural inclination, orientation. That is, they're equally attracted to both sexes. And that's something that is overlooked in our society that tends to just politicize sexual identity. And I would say if one is naturally bisexual, then one should live a naturally bisexual life. That is, if one meets someone of the opposite sex and one is attracted to that person, then one should pursue that relationship. And if one meets someone of the same sex that one is attracted to, one should pursue that relationship, so long as there's no deception, and so long as one is honest. I don't believe in people lying and deceiving other people, even in a heterosexual relationship. If you're wanting to see other people, you should be upfront with your partner. So I think, strictly speaking, there is something called a bisexual sexual orientation where people are equally attracted to both sexes. And that seems to be not chosen. That is, there are just genuinely those people who have that orientation, and it doesn't seem to be chosen. They didn't decide to be attracted to both sexes. And I think that's inescapable. If that's who they are, that's who they are. Sexuality, I think, exists on a continuum, actually, from 1 to 10, with some people having strong inclination towards heterosexuality or homosexuality. And under certain conditions, I think a certain orientation can be drawn out more than others. No, the second question, I think, is not so hard. I think what is happening is children are being used as pawns in a politicized end game to win a political battle. That is, children are being over-sexualized before their sexual orientation is fully developed. I think up until a certain period, I didn't know that I was truly gay until I was around 17. I suspected I was around 12, but I wasn't really sure because I was attracted to girls also and experimenting sexually with girls. But to know fully your sexual identity and your sexual orientation, there's a way in which the stage of puberty really has to come to a sense of completion. Some children just know before others, but this idea of sabotaging and manipulating children's sexual orientation or their sexual identity before they themselves have come to, in an autonomous, sovereign way, a conclusion, is actually, I think, quite evil. I think it's violating their sovereignty and violating their autonomy. And it's treating children as if they're autonomous, sovereign adults when they're not their children. And the best way is to just organically to allow the child to develop naturally, and to see where his orientation or her orientation develops. But this idea of puberty blockers, because a child at 9 years old has determined, or to have a coming out party, for the child at 8 years old, because the child declares at 8 years old that he's gay, is ludicrous. The child is a prepubescent child. I don't know any psychologist who would reasonably say that at 8 years old, a child can definitively know his sexual orientation. There are lots of children who experiment prepubescently and then go on to lead very heterosexual lives and look back at their experimental lives, preteen experimental lives, you know, with a kind of humor. And I've seen this over and over again. Even I'm 56. I remember speaking to people in my generation, people I went to school with, who experimented with each other when they were like 9 or 10 or 11 and would never consider themselves gay now, would actually not be repulsed, but would find no sort of attraction to a man, or happily married to women, have lots of children. But it's natural for children to go through these kinds of experimentation as their sexual orientation is being, you know, is being formed, and as they're coming into finding what their sexual orientation is. So that's a very easy one. I think this is just children, parents preempting and over-sexualizing their children for very nefarious reasons.
Should it be banned? Do you think the practice of administering, you know, those hormone blockers, I see that as kind of the threshold, if you will, because, or surgery, you know, something that's kind of non-reversible as the threshold. Yeah.
Well, I think it's a form of child abuse in the sense that you are ineradicably altering something that a child may later come to. Anything that is any interference of a child's development that is on a developmental stage before completion, that is, we know that children's brains are still developing until they're 20 years old, right? I think it's until you're 25 years old that neuroscientists say that, you know, the brain is still basically fully formed, which is why I have great empathy. I just came from teaching before entering Clubhouse, teaching my students who are 18 to 21. I have great a soft spot for my students, as annoying as they are and as woke as they are. I just remind myself, their brains are still forming, Jason. Their brains are still forming. They're still malleable. They're children. They're still children in a way. Anything that sabotages or disrupts the development, the natural developmental stage of a child's sexual, physiological development is criminal. And yes, I think should be banned, because it's violating the child's natural development in a way that could inevitably stymie his full or her full development as a human being. And that seems to me a violation of individual rights. That is, a child has a right to develop his or her capabilities to their fullest, and until they reach a stage where the capabilities are at least fully developed.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. And we have 10 more minutes, and we have four people I want to get to. I know they have really great questions. So we're going to do kind of a quick round robin. Alan, if you could summarize your question for Professor Hill briefly.
Thanks for saying what you just said about 18 and 19-year-olds still being kids, because I agree with that. It seems to me that her position on sexual orientation was based on whether or not the person, whether it was, I think the term you used was natural versus a choice. Would you say that's correct? And second of all, it seems to me that there's been some debate within the gay community itself whether or not it is something that you're born with, or if it's something that is chosen, which I am of the opinion it can be both. But I'm wondering I'm wondering what the prevailing belief in society was at the time she made her statements, and whether what she stated was consistent with what the rest of society was saying, or if she was going against whatever the particular narrative was at the time.
Thank you. Thanks, Alan.
Well, I think what she was saying was consistent with what was the prevailing, you know, view. I mean, it had just been a couple of years since the APA had removed from the DMS homosexuality as a pathology, a perversion, and a sort of mental illness. But I think even if we grant that homosexuality has a biological component and an environmental component, that it is still not the way we think of choice. That is something that we deliberate upon, that we have competing alternatives. Speaking in an Aristotelian way, the way Aristotle thinks about choice that leads to action, that is, we have competing alternatives, that we weigh the pros and cons, that we are consciously aware of. So one would have to be consciously aware of the environmental factors that are converging upon the formation of one's sexual orientation, and be aware of the inimical impact, how they're inimical to well-being, or how they contribute to well-being, and then to reject them. I just don't see how gay people in this world are consciously aware of the environmental impacts that weigh on their sexual orientation. So even if, and I would grant you that I think there is a strong environmental component that converges with a biological component, I think it's way outside the sphere of one's ability to consciously choose orientation. That is, one chooses one's partners, but it's way outside the ambit of choice talk. That is, the way we talk intelligently about choice doesn't seem to be the way that gays talk about choosing sexual orientation. So when we talk about choosing a mate or choosing a career or choosing to go to a particular destination, just the intelligent way that we talk about making choices, where there's deliberation, for example, there's an awareness of alternatives, there's an awareness of consequences, and we make rational choices. I don't see that playing a role in the domain in which choice is made in terms of sexual orientation among gays.
Thank you, Jason. Daniel, thanks for your patience. We've got Daniel, then I want to go to Willow and Vanessa.
Thank you. I'm enjoying a lot the conversation. Wonder, Jason, if you, what do you think about Nathaniel's Brandon account of his relationship with Ayn Rand? That was like a anecdotal, not necessarily purely philosophical thing, but nevertheless, when I was learning about Ayn Rand, the account of Nathaniel really like gave me a perspective that I was not that I'm not able to this day to have in account when I think about her.
Well, I read Judgment Day. I read Barbara Brandon's account. I've never met either of them, and I think, you know, having read both their biographies, I've enjoyed a lot. First of all, I've enjoyed a lot of Nathaniel Brandon's books, and I see no reason to adopt the doctrinaire, you know, Leonard Peikoff and that school of thought that he's a demonic, evil person. I do think that he was a young man who was under the influence of Ayn Rand's spell, that she wanted the affair, he wanted the affair, and that there's a great deal of credibility to what he has to say about her character. Certainly, he was a great spokesman in the NBI Institute in disseminating her philosophy, And I tend not to get caught up in this cultish, this whole nonsensical cult surrounding Ayn Rand. I don't think any rational, self-respecting person should have anything to do with any kind of cult. You can't have a cult of individuals, as Ayn Rand said. So I take what Nathaniel says, just, you know, try to pick out the objective pieces as they correspond with how Rand herself represented herself, and try not to have any kind of personal opinion about Nathaniel Brandon, because I don't know him personally, but just see how his representation of Rand aligns itself with objectivism itself as she represented it, and that's how I judge him. But I have no personal opinion of his character or praise of his character or anything like that. I just think in some sense he was a wonderful spokesperson for objectivism, especially in his essays in the Objectivist newsletter and the Objectivist magazine.
Yes, quickly. So, from your point of view,
Daniel, sorry, okay. No, we've got to get to the other questions, but we will be back next week, and it might be interesting to get the other scholars' take on that as well. Willow,
I'm actually my question just kind of slipped away from the moment. I'll just pass it to Vanessa. Thank you.
All right. Well, and hey, welcome to Clubhouse. So glad to have you with us.
Thank you.
Vanessa.
Okay. So I just wanted to ask, this thing of parents assuming their kids' sexual orientation, could it have to do with the parents' own sexual insecurities? I've seen cases where parents believe their kids are, I don't know, their boys are gay just because they choose to wear pink. And pink is just a color, and it's something, you know, society has chosen to make, you know, a girl's color, but it's just that. So it's ridiculous. And I wonder, maybe it's just because of parents, you know, own sexual insecurities.
I don't know. I think it goes deeper than that. I think I'm more heavily influenced by, dare I say, Freud's. There's a biological component, and then there's a way in which a child. I do believe that there's a part of homosexuality that results in a kind of sexual arrested development, in the sense that the child's relationship, the boy's relationship, at least with his mother, it gets. The mother co-opts the boy as her surrogate husband and sort of communicates to him that if he loves any other woman besides her, the love is going to be compromised. I rethink seriously about that notion of the dynamics, the family dynamics, and the absent father, and the absence of a strong father figure to reinforce a sense of masculinity. I don't think it would be anything as trivial as a parent's, like the way you've described it. I think it would be something much stronger than like a domineering mother and an absent father. And there, I think an environmental factor could play a role in having an influence on a child's sexuality that the poor child has nothing and no control over, because it starts from the child is probably in the womb or outside of the birth of the child, where the mother cathects the child and uses the child as a surrogate husband to fulfill her needs against an unsatisfying husband. But this is all conjectural. Freud could never prove this scientifically. But I do think it's worth thinking about in terms of an environmental phenomenon that could have a deep impact on the formation of a child's sexuality. That's worth thinking about.
A lot worth thinking about here. So thank you very much, Professor Hill. We are at time. So I want to thank all of you for coming and joining this discussion. And also a special thanks to all of you who raised your hand and asked a question, shared your views. We are going to be back next week. We've got a couple of exciting clubhouses with Rob Trusinski on the 5th, talking about Ayn Rand and the aesthetics of music. And then another clubhouse that is sure to be very interesting with Professor Stephen Hicks. He's going to be doing an Ask Me Anything. So I hope, Daniel, you'll bring your question back then. So thanks, everyone.